We are taking a journey every Sunday through the life of Jesus, through the life of Jesus. And we've been doing it for a while. We have the rest of this year, we have a lot of content to cover. And last week, we saw Jesus heal two people who needed healing, but he did it on the Sabbath day, and that caused some anger amongst the religious community because we don't do that on the Sabbath day, but Jesus did it anyway, and he had to answer his critics. And he's done that like seven times. We've seen that story happen over and over again. But last week, our final story, I want to remind you of the setting. The setting was that he was at a house of a religious leader or a Pharisee for a banquet, not because this religious leader was a Jesus follower, but because this religious leader wanted to have a celebrity at his house. Jesus was a celebrity. When he came to town, the synagogues would have him speak because he would bring a crowd because he healed people. And so he would speak, whether the synagogue leader agreed with him or not, they'd have him speak. When he came to people's house, they'd have him at their house because it was Jesus. And so, but they were scrutinizing him, and Jesus is the main guest. And as we saw last Sunday, they brought in a man who was sick just to test Jesus to see if he would heal this man on the Sabbath day, because that was a hot button issue back then. And Jesus went ahead and healed the man. He tried to get everyone to understand why. They wouldn't answer him. He healed the man. He sent him on his way, and then he said to everybody, "Don't be hypocrites. All of you, on the Sabbath, they would pull your son out of a pit or your cow out of a pit because you care about those things even on the Sabbath day. So let's care for other people just as much." And so he says, don't pick and choose. People are good at picking and choosing which scriptures we obey and which scriptures we judge others for not obeying, right? He says, don't do that. And he taught us that people are the point. People are the point. That was last week. And today, we pick up the story right there. Jesus is at the same place. He's at the same house. He's still eating there. All that we saw last week happens, and then what happens today happens next. And Jesus is going to teach two lessons that go together while sitting there waiting to eat. I want you to see them with me. Luke 14, verse 7. It says, "When Jesus noticed that all who had come to the dinner were trying to sit in the seats of honor near the head of the table, he gave them this advice." So apparently, early on, he healed that man. People were still arriving for the feast. And he looks around and he realizes that everyone's trying to get the important seats. In culture back then and in culture today, sometimes there are events where there are seats of importance and seats that everyone wants to have. And I don't mean like sporting events where everyone wants to sit in the 50-yard line in the front row, or Baptist churches where they want to sit in the back row or whatever. I'm talking about different kinds of things where seats indicate importance. Importance. Can someone tell me, I'm going to ask you to participate here, someone tell me of a kind of event today where there might be seating that is based upon, you know, you're seated where you are based upon honor or importance in the situation, that seating is intentional for certain events. Even today, seating matters. Where you sit is symbolic. Anybody can tell me one? Was that what you were going to say? Yes, ma'am.
I was thinking right away about like in the school districts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a good one. Absolutely. In fact, we have our scholarships at Hanover. They'll put the kids right up front who are going to get honored, and they'll stage them there, and they'll have their, exactly, that's a very good example. And then the seats are reserved. They'll reserve signs for the right people. That's a good one. Anybody else? I heard someone call one out, I thought, too. What's that?
Weddings
is a great example, too. Absolutely. In fact, weddings are kind of a weird one because sometimes, okay, oftentimes you have the head table where the bride and groom sit, and the bridal party might sit with them, but then you might have assigned seats so that the immediate family can sit close by, and maybe some close friends, and then some weddings, every seat's assigned. And then people come in and say, "Why am I sitting way back here?" I personally never care where I sit at a wedding, unless it's close family, I want to be where I, you know, close. But if I'm attending a wedding, I just want to sit in the section where they're going to be dismissed to the buffet line first. That's my goal. Give me closest to the buffet line, okay? Anyhow, but some weddings, they're like, we're not going to assign any seats. But then someone important might be sitting further back, so they're going to maybe selectively assign some seats, and the rest are a free-for-all. That's a good example. Who else? What's another time where people care about a seating symbolizes importance, perhaps? A funeral? Yeah, sure, right. The front couple rows sometimes the family, okay. Anybody else? There's a good one. State of the Union or presidential inaugurations, where you have to be invited and you get certain seats, and it's all about not only becoming, but where you're seated, you know, where you'll be seen in the camera. How about in business? You ever go to a board meeting where they have like a long table and the head of the table is where the main person sits, the important person sits, and the most important seats besides that person is to the right of them is the second seat of honor, the left is the next one, and then from there it's all who needs who next to them. And they're always facing at the head of the table, away from the door, so they can see who's coming and going. Even in Jesus' day, the Roman Empire had introduced a seating system that was sort of shaped like a U-shaped set of tables arranged. It could be very small, like one table with couches on three sides, or it could be a bunch of tables with couches on the outside, and the middle could be where people would bring food to serve or do entertainment. But on the outside, people would recline on couches as seats. And that was actually probably the kind of seating that was at the Last Supper. People always think the Last Supper from the paintings. Remember Jesus' Last Supper? The paintings you see, they're at this long table, all on the same side of the table, like they're taking an Instagram photo. That's like so weird, right? Like, why would no one would sit that way? You know, hey guys. So, but really they were probably sitting in this design, this U-shaped design that was common back then. But even in that scenario, there were seats of importance and honor and seats where the servants would sit closer to the door to go get more food or whatever. And Jesus is noticing at this particular feast, people are arriving and they're looking for the important chairs. And he said, I'm going to give them some advice. Now, this is not a crowd of people that was necessarily his followers, but he wants to help everybody. And so he says in verse number 8, when you are invited to a wedding feast, he uses a wedding as an example. When you are invited to a wedding feast, don't sit in the seat of honor. What if someone who is more distinguished than you has also been invited? I imagine somebody is hearing this and saying, who is more distinguished than me? Well, what are you talking about? And Jesus says, if that happens, the host, verse 9, the host will come and say, hey, give this person your seat. Then you will be embarrassed and you will have to take whatever seat is left at the foot of the table. Imagine that happening. You come to the wedding. There's all these important chairs. You're like, I'm early. And you look down the row and the best seats in the house are open. No one's there yet. You're like, ooh, I'm going to get a good one because I was here. So I'm going to go sit in one of the really good seats. You pass all the lower ones. You take one of the prime seats. You're so proud of yourself. And then the house starts filling up. People take the seats that are left over, you're happy. And then all of a sudden the host comes over and says, oh, hey, I'm so sorry. I have some very important guests. I want them to have these seats. Would you mind moving? Oh, man, that's the worst because it's embarrassing. Now I got to get up and it's kind of, I was told to, which is even worse. I didn't choose, so I was told to. You got to go down and now those mid-tier seats that you skipped because you wanted a better one, they're all full now. You got to go past those even. What's even left in here? Oh, man, way down here at the foot of the table. And it's embarrassing. Here's why it's embarrassing. Because the kind of person who would sit at an important seat probably is somebody who cares about how they appear. They care about their status, right? That's why they sat in the important seat. Unless they're just absent-minded, airheaded. They're like Dory. Oh, a chair, you know. They don't know. But unless that's their story, they're probably like, I sat here on purpose. And now for that kind of a person to be asked to get up and move because more important people need those seats and then find whatever's left down at the end, oh, it'd be embarrassing. Jesus says, don't do that to yourself. Just pray. By the way, let me just go on to say this before I go any further. If ever you hear someone teaching, because I know we're very critical today in social media, if you ever hear someone teaching what you think in church or something about life, and you think that's not very spiritual, that's just practical business wisdom or family relationship wisdom, Jesus was full of advice that doesn't seem very gospel-centered sometimes. He just was teaching about how to live better. Just keep that in mind. Jesus would say things like, where to sit at a wedding feast, why does that matter? But he was full of practical teaching that every part of our lives could benefit. Don't forget that. Anyhow, what should we do instead? Jesus says in verse 10, he says, instead, take the lowest place at the foot of the table. Then, when your host sees you, he will come and say, friend, we have a better place for you. And then you'll be honored in front of your other guests, all the other guests. He says, why don't you take a low seat? Now, he's not trying to teach someone some little life hack or some gaming hack. Oh, if I choose this seat, wink, wink, then they'll move me up higher. That's not the point. Although to the crowd he's speaking to, it might be the point for them because they were all concerned about their status. But if you know Jesus' teaching, if you've been around Jesus' teaching, you know that Jesus taught those who followed him, they should take the lower seat for an entirely different reason. And that is because we want to have servant leadership. We want to serve others. We want to give others the opportunity. It's a teaching on humility. We often think of humility as being the opposite of pride, and pride is thinking too highly of ourselves. So humility means we should be thinking low of ourselves. But that's not true. That's not humility. I want to give you this definition. Humility isn't thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. It's not thinking less of yourself. It's not like, I'm a nobody. It's not walking into the wedding feast saying, attention, everybody, notice me. I'm going to sit in these lowly seats because that's the kind of person I am. If you want to move me up, feel free. That's not what it's not coming in like Eeyore. It's just me. I'll just sit down here because it's probably all I deserve. That's not humility. Humility isn't thinking too high or low. It's not thinking less of yourself. It's just thinking of yourself less. It's walking in and saying, I want to think of somebody else. It's servant leadership that says, you know what I want to do? I want somebody else to have the seat. Because here's why. When I come to the wedding feast and there's only so many seats, I want to sit in a good one. Guess who else wants to sit in a good one? Everybody. Well, I'm not less important than them, nor am I more important, but we all want it, so I'll let them. After all, they can have the window seat on the airplane. It's okay. I don't have to have it. Let me just be a servant and say, I'll sit back here and let somebody else enjoy it. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. It's just saying, how can I serve? How can I think of others? How can I be others focused? Not make it about me. Pride makes it about me. I deserve the best seat. I was here. No one's better than me. Me, I'm right. I'm gonna fight for my piece of the pie. Humility says, go ahead. I'm glad that you're enjoying it. How can I help? And Jesus is appealing to people who necessarily weren't very humble, but that's what he taught his followers to do. But he also taught them, look, if serving others doesn't ring a bell for you, then do it for your dignity's sake. Because if you sit in a high chair, if you sit in high seats, you might get humbled. In fact, here's what he says next. I love verse 11. Jesus says, for those who exalt themselves will be humbled. And those who humble themselves will be exalted. This is a big idea. When we exalt ourselves, have you ever seen this happen before? You ever see somebody who's always puffing themselves up and arrogant and better than everybody else, and then something happens to them and they kind of get humbled? And everyone should feel bad, but everyone kind of grins because they're like, they had that coming, you know? Or you ever see somebody who's just a humble, gracious, serving kind of person, and they get recognized, and everyone's like, good, they deserve that. Now, don't raise your hand, but I wonder how many of us have ever been on the personal end of this. Have we ever gotten too full of ourselves, gotten too far in front of our own skis, and then all of a sudden something happens that knocks us down a few pegs in life and humbles us a little bit? Ouch. Or done something good for others for no other reason than to do good, and it turns around and gets recognized. This is a verse we ought to memorize. This is a verse that ought to be written down somewhere in our life. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Doesn't sound super much like gospel, does it? Doesn't sound like Jesus is saying, this is the story about the cross of, I'm about it. It's just life application, and the Bible's full of it. But he's not done. He has one more story to tell. He has one more teaching to give. In verse number 12, it says, then he turned to his host. When you put on a luncheon or banquet, he said. Now, let's pause there. He turns to the host because just now he just told everybody else in the room, when you come to a party like this, don't look for the best seats. Take the lower seats. Let other people have them. Have a humble mindset. And by the way, if you want to be exalted, you can be exalted from there, but don't exalt yourself. He's telling that to the attendees. Now he's talking to the host. Not just for the host's sake, but for anyone else who will ever throw a similar banquet. He says, let me give you some advice too. When you put on a luncheon or a banquet, he said, don't invite your friends, brothers, relatives, and rich neighbors, for they will invite you back. And that will be your only reward. Now, that's kind of a peculiar verse. Can we be honest? Is Jesus just saying that we should never invite our family and friends to a get-together? That's weird. Like, is that what he's saying? Like, I call mom, dad, sorry, you can't come over this next week for the party. The Bible, you know, sorry. No, that's not what he's not saying don't invite, never have your family over. He's not saying never get together with your friends. That's not his point. What he's saying is this, those are the people we always cater to. We always do it for our friends circle. We always do it for our family, right? And that's good. But if you want to know what he's trying to say, the important thing he adds that gives us clarity is the last group, the rich neighbors. And that shows us what Jesus is trying to say. He's saying that what we tend to do is we tend to throw events where we bring in people who can benefit us, right? It benefits me. I want to be close to my family. We should be. I want my friends to be, you know, I want the rich people. I want the people to invite me back. If you have a family get together and you don't invite some of your family, they probably ain't inviting you to theirs. If you have friends and you don't invite your friends over, they're not going to get invited to theirs. So you know what you do? You invite them back, so they'll invite you back. And the rich neighbors is the key. What he's saying is all these groups are people that for good or bad reasons, we bring them in for personal benefit. If the rich neighbor has to invite me over to his party, I'll go into a real nice party. It's called networking, right? I just want to network. I'm just trying to build my community. I'm just networking with some people who can give me a job or a promotion or, you know, an opportunity, right? So you invite people for personal reasons. It's called, there's a term for it. It's called reciprocal reception. Reciprocal reception. I don't know why I have a weird brain, okay? Don't judge me. I have a weird brain. But my brain thought of this week. I remember earlier in my adult life, I saw a lot of people, I knew a lot of people who got hung up on sending Christmas cards out to all their friends. Because they're like, we got to send Christmas cards. People put them on their mantle or their fireplace or in their doorway. We send Christmas cards to everyone who sent us one so we don't offend anybody. I remember people saying, oh no, I got a Christmas card late in the season from somebody and we didn't send them one. Quick, where are the spare cards? We got to fill one out and send it to them so they won't be offended. Now, I just want to say this to you. If you send people Christmas cards in expectation that they send you one back or you're going to be offended, you're doing it for the wrong reasons, man. I just encourage you to stop that game. That's a silly game to play. Just do it because you want to do it, but don't do it for something in return, right? Reciprocal reception. Hey, I'll throw a party and invite you so that you have to invite me to yours. And the rich neighbors show us that we're only inviting people who inviting them will get me to some other party which might benefit me and help me network. And Jesus is not saying that that is bad. That's not bad. He's not saying that's wrong. There's no punishment for doing this. In fact, there's a reward. But the reward is what? You get invited back. And some of us are like, Arlen, that's the only reward I want. I want to go to the big parties. So that's good enough for me. But Jesus is suggesting, what if there's a better reward? And he's about to give them some advice that I don't think anybody in the room wanted to hear. It's kind of like his last advice. Sit at the low seats. Sit at the low seats? Are you kidding me? That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. He said, no, do that. Humble yourself. He's about to give them some more advice that will be foreign to the crowd. Are you ready for it? He says in verse 13, instead, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. I think when Jesus said this, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. Why would I do that? What could they possibly do for me? They can't throw a party for me. You know what the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind would have in those days, and most of them today's days too, really? Destitute, struggling, needing support and help. They're not well off. What can they do for me? Jesus wasn't saying not to have parties for everybody else. He's not saying don't have parties for your family. He's saying, why are all of your parties all about what benefits you? Why are all of your efforts about what you get out of it? Why don't you bring someone along sometime that no one ever invites because they can't invite you back. Who does that? I mean, first of all, there's a financial loss to throw a party. If I invite the rich people, they might bring gifts to me and it makes me offset my cost for my party. No one's going to bring me anything in this group. In fact, I'll probably cost more money. I'm going to need more help because you got to watch out for the poor ones. They might steal something, you know. They know they don't know where I live now. Watch the silverware. Where's the silverware at? And the other ones, the blind, they need someone to help them sit down. The people with handicaps need to have space. I mean, there's just, listen, I need more staff. It's just too expensive. And they can't even give me anything back. So I think people looked at Jesus like, what are you saying? Who would do that? Because I don't think anyone would say it out loud, but I think some people in the back of their subconscious brain were asking this question. What's in it for me? What's in it for me? Seriously. Here's the trick. When you invite all the other people, they're going to have a party for you too. But you know what's crazy about the blind and the poor and the handicapped that are mentioned in that verse? Is that nobody ever invites them. They can spend their entire life and never go to one party. Because who's going to do that? He said, well, you're all sharing your umpteenth party between friends. It's your turn, it's your turn, it's your turn to host. What about people who never get invited? Yeah, but why would I want to do that? What's in it for me? And Jesus is suggesting that sometimes we should do good things for nothing in return. We always want to know what I get out of it. What's the something I get? What if it's nothing? Sometimes it's about being good for nothing. And that's a cliche we use, being good for nothing, right? But that's a good point. It's about being good, not for something I get in return, but because it's just good to be good. I'm not doing it for return. I'm doing it for free. I'm going to be good for nothing. That's a good thing, right? Does it sound like a compliment to you? Everyone turn to the person sitting next to you right now and look at them and say, hey, you're good for nothing. All right? Isn't that good? Now, here's the thing. If someone just said that to you, look at them and say, thank you, and so are you, okay? Now, Jesus says sometimes we ought to strive just to be good for goodness sake, not what's in it for me, not how can I climb the social ladder, how can I get a better seat at the party, or how can I throw a party with people who will invite me to theirs later, how can I help someone that is marginalized and overlooked, but God loves, and be good for them, though they can do nothing back for me. Is there something in it for me? Well, there actually is. Look at verse 14. Jesus said, then, at the resurrection of the righteous, God will reward you for inviting those who could not repay you. That's interesting. Here's the problem. The resurrection of the righteous, I don't want to wait that long. Joey, I just was hoping maybe something a little faster, you know? I also hope I can make some connections and benefit next week from it. Resurrection of the righteous, I'm hoping that my personal afterlife story is a long time from now, not next week, okay? And so I don't want to wait that long for my reward. Does God reward us in this life for doing good? I believe he does. In fact, we're going to see a story in a few weeks here before Easter where Jesus talks, or maybe it's one after, I can't remember, somewhere in there. Jesus talks and says, look, you do good, and God will reward you both in this life and in the life to come. But here's what he's saying. Sometimes you do something good, and it don't pay off immediately, but at the very least, if not sooner, in the end, God will reward you. And if we don't have faith that there is a day like that coming, then why would we care? Why would we do good? I believe that looking ahead and believing God's promises of eternal life should never make us less worldly good. They should make us more worldly good. Because they challenge us to care for people, knowing that God will take care of the rest. He'll repay us. There's a verse in Proverbs. 1,000 years before Jesus walked this earth, King Solomon once wrote this verse. Those who give to the poor are lending to the Lord. Now we lend to the poor. Lending to the poor is problematic because they can't pay you back. Or if they do, you're usually trying to charge them interest to make your money back, which means you're making them even more poor because they're going to stay in a bad spiral. That's not helping anybody. That's getting rich off of other people's poverty. But if you give to the poor, say, well, how do I get that paid back? If you give something to somebody, they can't pay you back. It's no big deal. I gave it to you. It's no big deal. But it's a loan to the Lord, and God always pays his bills. God always pays his debts. The resurrection of the righteous, God will one day, in this life or the next, repay those, reward those who do for others what others cannot repay them for. And so that's the idea. What Jesus is saying is simply this, that no good deed goes unrewarded. No, not to counter the beautiful and talented Miss Alphaba and her bad moment of sorrow, where she thought no good deed goes unpunished in the movie Wicked. But truthfully, and even that story taught us that this ultimately works out, that no good deed goes unrewarded, that not that every good deed becomes rewarded that moment. You can do something good for somebody and they don't return the favor. John, you can give of yourself to somebody and they might turn their back on you, stab you in the back, walk away. That happens. But if they don't repay you for your good work, God will. And so the question becomes this: what reward do you want? That's really the question. What reward do you want? Just to socialize with the rich neighbors and get some connections that might move my life forward in some good way? Sit at a higher seat at the table so I look important by people around me? Or can we take a humble path, not thinking less of ourselves, no, thinking of ourselves less, thinking of others more, saying, you can have a better seat, I'll be okay. How can I help you have a good experience? I'll throw a party, but I'll invite people who no one wants to invite because someone needs to care for them. If you do that, you're passing on the rewards that all the people of the world chase. And here's the crazy thing about it. We're supposed to not think like the world. We conform to this world. We're supposed to have a Christ mindset, a humble serving mindset. But to do that, you got to decide that I don't need the rewards this world offers me. I'm seeking a better reward. What reward do you want? And it just takes a certain approach. I was going to tell a story today, but I knew that I would run out of time. I want to wrap up in a couple minutes here. I was going to tell a story. I probably have time because I'm doing better than I thought I was, but it's going to be about 10 minutes. I didn't tell it last hour, so I'm going to not tell it this hour. But I'll just quickly say, when Michelle and I, I'll say this real quick, when Michelle and I first went to Bible college, got involved in a very large church that we were a part of there. And they were looking for people to join their ministries to get involved in outreach ministry. There was a lot of jobs to do in the organization there that all the young aspiring ministry workers wanted to be in. They were fun. They were fun departments to work in. All their friends would be there. Michelle and I were not officially dating yet, but we were moving that direction. We were friends. And we came together as freshmen, and we attended this. We saw all the opportunities, and both of us realized separately and then together that everyone was overlooking certain groups. We had a group of kids that were educably slow and, you know, mentally disabled, and no one wanted to care for them, children, and then teens and adults. And Michelle and I said, well, these are understaffed departments because they're hard jobs and no one wants them. Let's do them. We both signed up for different departments. Eventually, we got engaged and we joined the same department. And for 7 years, we did that. I'll tell you the story more because it's such a rich part of our life. We did not know what we were getting at. We just were trying to meet a need that no one wanted to meet. I cannot tell you how much that blessed our entire lives. How much that did for us, how much it prepared us for the rest of our days, for ministry. There was payoffs from doing that I never expected and never fathomed. We didn't do it for that reason, but it reminded me that sometimes when you do something because God knows that there's a need, that God blesses you in ways that you can't quantify. He blesses you in ways that you wouldn't expect. We measure rewards the wrong way sometimes, and they just come and enrich your lives in 1,000 ways you never expected. What reward do you want? If you were to ask me, Arlen, what reward do you want? I'll tell you what it is, but I get emotional sometimes when I say it. I've said it before. What I want more than anything in this world is one day when my time is up and I stand before God, I want to hear my Lord look at me and say, Arlen, well done, my good and faithful servant. I don't know that he will. I hope so. I have my own insecurities that would happen. I hope so. I want him to say, this is my son. I am well pleased with you, right? Well done. That's better than anything this world can offer. Everything else feels like fool's gold in comparison. But what about you? What reward do you want? They follow the ways of the world, fight for our pecking order, fight for our importance, climb the ladder, step on other people, dog eat dog, survival of the fittest, win at all cost. Or we could humbly serve and defer to others and use our opportunities to make other people's lives better with nothing that they can do for us in return, knowing that God will reward that. The question is, what reward do you want? That's some good advice Jesus gave. It was kind of practical. Nothing about his advice was anything like, you know, go be a missionary. Here's the gospel in 4 points. It was just like, here's how you go to a wedding feast. Here's how you throw a party. But notice that he brought spiritual and eternal implications into how we live our daily lives, because how we live and treat each other matters to God, and he's the one I want to please. How about you?